Guardian Unlimited.
Our guest tonight has been a teacher, an editor, but she joins us tonight as the renowned writer of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. She is, of course, Susanna Clarke, here to celebrate the paperback publication of her latest bestseller, The Ladies of Grace Adieu. The format of the evening will be as follows. Susanna will be in conversation with legendary author Neil Gaiman. She will also be reading from her new book, The Ladies of Grace Adieu, and taking questions from your good selves. Due to health reasons, Susanna will be unable to do a book signing this evening. Please take a moment now to switch off your mobile phones. And please, no flash photography during the event. So please welcome to the stage Neil Gaiman and our very special guest, Susanna Clarke.
So the last time we did this, we were in New York.
Yeah, we were, and the view is so similar, we could almost be in the same place.
The conversation could continue. We were talking about Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell back then. This time, pronounce the title of your new short story collection for me.
Well, as many people point out, particularly my mother, it ought to be The Ladies of Grace Adieu, because it's supposedly an English place name. Not, I think, a terribly likely English place name, but being an English place name, it ought to have been anglicised. But I pronounce it as The Ladies of Grace Adieu, which is completely wrong, so don't follow what I do, because I say it wrong. It's foolish to have a title that you can't pronounce, but I'm actually not the only one. I do know of an author who has, a best-selling author, who has written a series of books, the titles of which he cannot pronounce. And I've seen him in interviews go to extraordinary lengths to sort of not say the title of his book. I won't say who it is, because I think I can point out my own failings, but perhaps not other people's. It's not you.
So if we promise not to tell anybody... No. Would you like to do a reading?
I would, actually. And I'm actually going to stand up and do it over here. I've actually chosen to read from... No, that's not a good idea. From Mr. C. Manelli, because in many ways it's kind of my favourite story. It's set in... this particular bit is set on September the 16th, 1811, which is pretty precise, as I think you'll agree. And it's the story, Mr. C. Manelli is a student at Cambridge University. And like many academics, you may be able to think of some, he's not only very clever, but he's also, more than that, he's extremely pleased with himself for being very clever. He tends to think, in fact, he always thinks that he's right and other people are wrong, and is quite baffled by the fact that they don't see it. He's also quite a young man, and although intellectually he's rather vain, he's not particularly vain of his good looks, which are extraordinary. He hasn't done terribly well at Cambridge University. He has very little money, and so he's been offered an opportunity to become a clergyman, which will provide him with a house and some sort of income in Derbyshire. And so he's decided to take this up. He's taken orders, become a clergyman, and when we join him, he is walking through the pouring rain along a road in rural Derbyshire on his way to his parish for the first time. You can imagine him with a very small package of clothes and perhaps a slightly larger package of books. I had begun to think I must be very near to the village when I turned a corner and saw, a little way ahead of me in the rain, two figures on horseback. They had stopped by a poor cottage to speak to someone who stood just within the bounds of the garden. Now, I am no judge of horses, but these were quite remarkable, tall, well-formed and shining. They tossed their heads and stamped their hooves upon the ground as if they scorned to be stood upon so base an element. One was black and one was chestnut. The chestnut in particular appeared to be the only bright thing in the whole of Derbyshire. It glowed like a bonfire in the grey, rainy air. The person whom the riders addressed was an old bent man. As I drew near, I heard shouts and a curse, and I saw one of the riders reach up and make a sign with his hand above the old man's head. This gesture was entirely new to me and must, I suppose, be peculiar to the natives of Derbyshire. I do not think that I ever before saw anything so expressive of contempt, and as it may be of some interest to study the customs and quaint beliefs of the people here, I append a sort of diagram or drawing to show precisely the gesture the man made. I concluded that the riders were going away dissatisfied from their interview with the old cottager. It further occurred to me that since I was now so close to the village, this ancient person was certainly one of my parishioners. I determined to lose no time in bringing peace where there was strife, harmony where there was discord. I quickened my steps, hailed the old man, informed him that I was the new rector, and asked him his name, which was Jemmy. "Well, Jemmy," I said, assuming a cordial manner and accommodating my language to his uneducated condition, "what has happened here? What have you done to make the gentleman so angry?" He told me that the rider of the chestnut horse had a wife who had that morning been brought to bed. He and his servant had come to inquire for Jemmy's wife, Joan, who for many years had attended all the women in the neighbourhood. "Indeed," said I, in accents of mild reproof. "Then why do you keep the gentleman waiting? Where is your wife?" He pointed to where the lane wound up the opposite hillside, to where I could just discern through the rain an ancient church and a graveyard. "Who takes care of the women in their child beds now?" I asked. There were, it seemed, two executors of that office, Mr. Stubb, the apothecary in Bakewell, or Mr. Horrocks, the physician in Buxton. But both these places were 2-3 hours hard ride away on bad roads, and the lady was already, in Jemmy's words, proper poorly. To own the truth, I was a little annoyed with the gentleman on the chestnut horse, who had not troubled until today to provide an attendant for his wife, an obligation which presumably he might have discharged at any time within the last 9 months. Nevertheless, I hurried after the two men and, addressing the rider of the chestnut horse, said, "Sir, my name is Simonelli. I have studied a great variety of subjects, law, divinity, medicine, at the University at Cambridge, and I have for many years maintained a correspondence with one of the most eminent physicians of the age, Mr. Matthew Bailey of Great Windmill Street in London. If it is not disagreeable to you, I shall be happy to attend your wife." He bent upon me, a countenance thin, dark, eager. His eyes were exceptionally fine and bright, and their expression unusually intelligent. His black hair was his own, quite long and tied with a black ribbon in a pigtail, rather in the manner of an old-fashioned queue wig. "And are you an adherent of Galenus or Paracelsus?" he said. "Sir," I said, for I thought he must intend the question as a joke. But then, since he continued to look at me, I said, The ancient medical authorities whom you mention, sir, are quite outdated. All that Galen knew of anatomy he got from observing the dissections of pigs, goats and apes. Paracelsus believed in the efficacy of magic spells and all sorts of nonsense. Indeed, sir, I said with a burst of laughter, you might as well inquire whose cause I espoused in the Trojan War as ask me to choose between those illustrious but thoroughly discredited gentlemen. Perhaps it was wrong to laugh at him. I felt it was wrong immediately. I remembered how many enemies my superior abilities had won me at Cambridge, and I recalled my resolution to do things differently in all hope and to bear patiently with ignorance and misinformation wherever I found it. But the gentleman only said, "Well, Dando, we have had better fortune than we looked for. A scholar, an eminent physician to attend my lady." He smiled a long, thin smile which went up just one side of his dark face. She will be full of gratitude, I have no doubt. While he spoke, I made some discoveries, to wit, that both he and his servant were amazingly dirty. I had not observed it at first because the rain had washed their faces clean. His coat, which I had taken to be of brown drugget or some such material, was revealed upon closer inspection to be of red velvet, much discoloured, worn, and matted with dirt and grease. I had intended to hoist the old woman up behind Dando, he said, but that will scarcely do for you. He was silent a moment and then suddenly cried, "Well, what do you wait for, you sour-faced rogue?" This startled me, but a moment later I understood that he addressed Dando. "Dismount, help the learned doctor to the horse." I was about to protest that I knew nothing of horses or riding, but Dando had already jumped down and had somehow tipped me onto the horse's back. My feet were in the stirrups and the reins were in my hands before I knew where I was. Now, a great deal is talked in Cambridge of horses, and the riding of horses, and the managing of horses. A great number of the more ignorant undergraduates pride themselves upon their understanding of the subject, but I find there is nothing to it. One has merely to hold on as tight as one can. The horse, I find, does all. Immense speed, godlike speed, we turned from the highway immediately and raced through ancient woods of oak and ash and holly. Dead leaves flew up, rain flew down, and the gentleman and I, like spirits of the sad grey air, flew between. Then up, up we climbed to where the ragged grey clouds tore themselves apart like great doors opening in heaven to let us through. By moorland pools of slate grey water, by lonely wind-shaped hawthorn trees, by broken walls of grey stones, a ruined chapel, a stream, over the hills, to a house that stood quite alone in a rain-misted valley. Thank you.
So, how did you become a short story writer? You didn't set out to be a short story writer, did you?
I didn't want to be a short story writer. Back in 93, I had just started what would eventually become Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. And it had been a while since I'd attempted doing any fantasy writing. I spent a long time on a detective novel that hadn't gone anywhere. So I thought I would do this in a very sort of sensible way. I thought I would go on a course for fantasy writing, and there looked like to be a good one up in Yorkshire. So I applied for this course, and I got on, it was a week-long course, and the tutors wrote back and said they'd like everybody to write a short story. And this was very annoying because I didn't want to write a short story. I wanted to talk about my novel. So I hit upon the idea of writing a short story, which became The Ladies of Grâce à Dieu, which was basically what Jonathan Strange did on his holiday. And so that was my first short story. And it turned out better than I expected. And then because the novel was taking me such a very long time, the tutor, Colin Greenland, who by that time had become my partner, suggested that I tried writing other short stories just to sort of keep them ticking over, just to, largely just so that I could get published, because clearly it was going to be a very long time before Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell was ready, if ever.
I remember getting, when did Colin send me The Ladies of Grasshopper? That would have been 19.
That would have been 94. He sent you a tiny bit of it, which was, in fact, there is a small section in Ladies of Grasshopper where one of the three heroines tells two little girls a bedtime story. And that bedtime story was, as you immediately picked up on, very influenced by you. And so Colin sent you the bit that was influenced by you. And
I just remember writing back and saying, where is the rest of this? Which he then sent me.
Yes, yes. And you sent me a very nice postcard with a peculiar man on the front of it.
Good. Did you know that he'd actually sent me this, or had he warned you, or had he merely sort of swiped it?
I think he'd swiped it, yes. So it was all a bit of a shock, really.
Must have come as more of a shock to you when the story got published.
That was a complete shock, because you then showed it to a New York editor, and I knew nothing of that. And I came home one day, and there was a voicemail. There was a message on my answering machine from this New York editor I'd never heard of, asking to see Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which was a bit premature because it would be 10 years before I finished it. but I did eventually agree to sell him the short story for a collection, and it was published in Starlight around about 96, I think.
So the stories, how many stories are there in Grasshopper?
9, I think.
And of them, 8 were sort of writing one every year, one every 18 months?
Yeah, something like that, I think. I think one year I actually managed to write 2. And then I must have taken a year off somewhere else. But yeah, that was pretty much it. 8 of them were written during the writing of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. And so something happened which I hadn't quite intended, which I hadn't quite foreseen, which was that I would try out ideas for the novel. They kind of fed back into the novel, particularly at the beginning when I wasn't quite sure how to handle fairies and the idea of fairy. Trying out things in short stories proved to be very, very useful. And so, in a weird way, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell was actually influenced by the short stories that I wrote.
One of the things that occurred to me also is there's a much stronger female presence,
yeah,
in the short stories.
Yeah. It always slightly disappointed me that the female characters of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, although I think they're very important and have a great deal of influence on what goes on, they are slightly sunk below the level. So they're a little bit lower down in the mix than the male characters, and that wasn't intentional, it was just the way it turned out. But in the short stories, a lot of them have female characters at the centre. And so that was another way the short stories helped, because they were a contrast in a way to this rather male orientated novel. I could go off and write female short stories, which was great.
And you also get to try out a bunch of different voices that sort of move away from the sort of the Austen-esque voice. Thinking particularly of something like On Licorice Hill, which I think of as your John Aubrey short story.
It was my John Aubrey short story. John Aubrey's great. He's so completely mad. Yes. You read Brief Lives, and he says things like, I must remember to ask so-and-so about this. And clearly he never did. And it's way too late now, but it's still there in the book. And it's so completely... they're just these tiny little bits of biography. But they're sort of so unconventional. When he's talking about somebody like Sir Walter Raleigh, he doesn't tell you the normal stuff about Sir Walter Raleigh. He tells you what a woman who Sir Walter Raleigh more or less molested in somewhere like Great Windsor Park said at the moment of orgasm. And that's his sort of tale about Sir Walter Raleigh.
Swisser Swasser,
which I think was a sort of...
Well, it
Sir
started
Walter,
off
Sir
as her protestations of... Of nay, sweet Sir Walter. No, sweet Sir Walter. No, sweet Sir Walter. Sweet Sir Walter. Swisser Swasser. Swisser Swasser.
That's it. Which is what John
this
Aubrey
is classical
feels.
Stuff. It's important. You know this.
Yeah. That's what John Aubrey thinks you need to know about Sir Walter Raleigh.
Yes, I think that's what I love best about John Aubrey is it's whatever he had in his head at that moment.
So I sort of invented, for On Licorice Hill, I sort of invented a kind of... So, John Aubrey actually appears as a character, but there's a sort of female John Aubrey, a young girl who's sort of got the same kind of mind, really, and who's just passionate about all kinds of learning, but has a rather doesn't realise quite how unconventional her thinking is. So yes, there were lots of different voices, and also, as in Mr. Simonelli, there's first-person narrative. And so, yes, it was a way to play, really. Although, as we were saying earlier, I find short story writing, in some ways, I do find it quite difficult, which is, I think, different from the way you view it.
Yes, I tend to view short story writing as like... it's the fun bit.
Yeah.
It's the...
We were both asked to write something about the difference between writing short stories and writing novels for Interzone, the science fiction and fantasy magazine. And you wrote your piece, and then they said, would I write something? And they sent me your piece, so I could have copied it, but I didn't, which was, I think, quite decent of me, really. But I said, you said that it was writing... a novel was like climbing a mountain, and writing a short story was like climbing a tree. And if I think about it, I think writing a novel is like climbing a mountain, which I know how to do. You just follow the path up. Writing a short story is like climbing a tree, but I have no idea how you climb trees. Not a clue. It is not my, that is not my, my talent at all. So I love short stories when they're finished, but the short form, as you might guess from the size of the novel, is it doesn't come entirely naturally. in some ways, short stories work best for me if I think of them as very long footnotes.
I remember once asking Roger Zelazny, back when he was still alive, about writing short stories and what for him the key to writing a good short story was. And he thought for a moment, puffed on his pipe, and then he said, I think all of my good short stories are the last chapters of novels I didn't get around to writing. Which I thought was a lovely way of thinking about a short story, that it's still that iceberg tip on top of something huge that simply doesn't happen to exist.
Or just a very, very small slice of something huge that you haven't bothered to map out. I think when I was a teenager, when I was young, I sort of read the Penguin Book of English Short Stories or something, and I think that put me off writing, trying to write short stories for a very long time, because I understood what short stories were meant to be. They were these tales of rather melancholy lives.
I was about to say, miserable people having small epiphanies of misery.
Something like that, yes. They were all like grey, rainy afternoons and rather desolate. Oh, I don't want to write that. What cured me of that was reading Jorge Luis Borges, his short fictions, which are just extraordinary and which might be anything. They might be about heretics, or they might be about Chinese gardens, or they might be about impossible universities or encyclopedias or something like that. And they might be just a page long, or, I mean, obviously I haven't been able to imitate his brevity, but I do like the sort of the wonderful mixture of subjects he crams into them.
Although the very last story that you did, which you did after Jonathan Strange and Mr. Noel, the one with the charcoal burner in it, actually is, it felt like you were sort of getting that brevity thing down.
Well, that was a footnote, actually. That was a footnote. Right towards the end, as I was finishing the novel, I got to a point where I really wanted to write a footnote with this story in, but I couldn't quite get the shape of the story or quite what it was about. So in the end, I thought, oh, I'll do it later. So I finished the novel, and then I sat down to write the first thing. And I think my instincts were right, because it was very long for a footnote, but as you say, quite short for a story.
And you got Charlie Vess to do the illustrations.
Yes, yes. Well, that was a great treat, because I'd only worked with Charles Vess once before, when you and he put together A Fall of Stardust, which was a little portfolio of mainly of artwork based on your created world of Stardust. I don't know why I'm telling this. So there were a lot of pictures people had done of the world of Stardust. And you wrote a little story, and you offered, I think, about 2,000 words to me and Colin. And I said to Colin, out of my way, this is mine. And I wrote The Duke of Wellington for you. And Charles was to illustrate it. But in the end, he could only do a few illustrations, which sort of frustrated me, because I'd hoped to see sort of wonderful Charles Vess illustrations in this little story. But so this was a chance to do it. I felt that somehow this sort of fairiness of the short stories was very suited to his wonderful fairy faces and his wonderful evocative landscapes. Despite living in Virginia, he's a great admirer of England, and he does do marvellous landscapes. He does make the hills a bit more Japanesey than they really are in England. He sort of gets carried away by the sinuous lines, and things keep climbing up and up when you think, no, English hill would finish about there, really. But nevertheless, they are wonderful things.
I was with him for what may actually have been the most miserable 5 days of his life, which was... We were going up to Scotland, Charles and I and my daughter, where he was going to finish the illustrations. And we got out of the taxi at Gatwick.
The illustrations for Ladies of Gracidia.
Yep, he had his entire portfolio of all of the illustrations on him when he got into the taxi. And there was a point where we got down, we're on the Gatwick Express, or possibly on the Heathrow Express, Heathrow Express in Paddington. And suddenly Charles looks around and realizes that there is no portfolio. And we had this incredibly miserable 4 days up in Scotland where he was meant to have been working, and instead he was putting a brave face on things. There is nothing scarier than an artist who has lost his entire portfolio putting a brave face on things. And then he was on the plane flying back down to London when I got a call from some incredibly nice police officer who just had this thing handed in.
Wow.
At the local police station. And that was all of the illustrations.
I don't think he admitted it to me till that point. I sort of got this email that said, we've lost all the artwork, but don't worry, it's going to be fine. So I'm just like, okay.
Just glad that it got handed
in. Absolutely.
We should probably take some questions. I have been told that even if you think that you've shouted loud enough for everybody to hear you, I should still repeat your question. For the hard of hearing and the people behind you. So, what would you like to know? Questions for Susanna? Questions about Grâce à Dieu? Questions about Jonathan Strange?
There's one over.
Somebody over there? Hand there. Yeah.
Where did you get your fairy lore from? Did you study fairy beforehand?
The question is, where did she get her fairy lore from? Did she get it from books? Are there places you can go and study this stuff? Or did she make it up?
I think about the second or third story that I wrote, on Licorice Hill anyway, was written for two American editors, Terry Windling and Ellen Datlow, who were doing a series of books on, which are stories based on fairy tales. And I, because I have a very literal mind in some ways, fairy tales to me meant tales about fairies, which wasn't really what they meant. So I felt I ought to go and research fairies. So I found a book in Waterstones, I guess, in Cambridge, which was Catherine Briggs's Dictionary of Fairies. Catherine Briggs, English folklorist, I think died about in the 1980s, something mm-hmm. like that, but active sort of from 1950s to 1980s, and was one of a number of women and men who just collected what was left of English folklore and beliefs about fairies and Scottish folklore and Cornish, which is different again, Irish. And so, yes, I did study quite a lot of Catherine Briggs's work. And I think one of the things which is very nice about British fairy lore or folklore is that it is so fragmentary. Because this, in a way, is a gift for a writer. If it was all laid out, then your imagination would have fewer cracks to get in and start working away at. So it actually helps, I think, that it is so... It is just scraps and pieces, because then you start to work on it. So, yes, I did... It's sort of a bit of both, really. You take what there is that's traditional... the idea, for example, that if a fairy licks your eye, puts his spittle on your eye, then you'll be able to see him as he really is. But up until that point, you probably see something much more glamorous than the ragged person living in a cave that he really is. So all of these are really interesting bits that you can do something with.
Did you ever find that faintly irritating thing in Briggs where you'll go and she'll reference something and you'll get and it won't be there? There's about four or five things in Briggs where you're reading along and you know and you'll get to a mention. Normally you get to they'll put them in capital letters, so she'll say, you know, see red caps or whatever, and you do and you learn something. And every now and then in Briggs she'll reference something and you'll go and find it and it isn't there.
I've always found it.
Maybe it was just my edition.
It might have been. They took those bits out.
They've gone and taken them out.
They thought he's writing too much about them.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Entries stolen by fairies. Right. Somebody else. Another question. Yes. Yep. Are there any more stories like the charcoal burner that are footnotes that you'd like to write?
I don't know. When I get a bit further on with the novel that I'm writing at the moment, that may well be the case. There's quite a few... There's bits that I want to go back to, which are stories in this collection. For example, I kind of feel that Mr. Simonelli, I haven't finished with him. He's an awkward character, and I feel he could be a catalyst for all sorts of things. And we were talking about this earlier, Tom Brightwind and David Montefiore. I say that there are lots of other stories. but I sort of make out this sort of what seemed like a fun idea at the time. There were this whole range of David and Tom stories. But I suspect if I do go back to them that I will... approach it from rather a different angle and maybe a darker angle rather than go over the same things twice. I think with Strange and Norrell, what might have been footnotes at this stage is more likely to be continued in the next book that I'm working on rather than be expanded into short stories.
Are any of the themes from, when you talk about Mr. Simonelli, for example, carrying on, is that likely to go into the next novel, or is that going to be after the next novel, or even during if you...
I don't know. Kay. I haven't decided yet.
The question is the look of the book, the design and the look and feel of Grassa Deer, particularly, or of Jonathan Strange? Mental imagery. Does it derive from paintings?
That's quite an interesting question. For Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, not so much. Or I think, although Dickens's illustrators were later, some of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, the sort of landscapes and things, was rather influenced by Dickens illustrators. And yes, I did look at some pictures, some paintings, some contemporary paintings. But for the interiors, for sort of drawing room scenes, what I find most interesting to look at is watercolours by women who did watercolours as a hobby at the time of Jane Austen. I mean, it's in Jane Austen that people drew and painted. There's a wonderful book called Mrs. Hurst Dancing, which is a collection of watercolours, and I cannot remember the girl's name, but she just did them for her own amusement, and she painted her family, and, I mean, they lived in a sort of Jane Austen-esque big house, and her brothers were soldiers, and she just painted the most... wonderful, really, in a very slightly naive style, but really kind of almost like family snapshots, but set in 1811 or 1815, of somebody falling off a donkey, or her brother when he was unlucky in love, sort of slumped in an armchair with his head in his hands whilst one of his sisters tried to cheer him up. And she also drew little word bubbles, so it's almost a comic of what they were saying. And these are wonderful things. Oh, and a very strange picture of them passing... You could get an electrifying machine, apparently, and then you'd all take hands and you'd electrify yourselves. And this was a thing to do in the evening when you couldn't think of anything else to do. So there was a picture of them all being electrified. So that was the sort of thing that was best. In fact, I almost referenced that in Jonathan Strange, Mr. Norrell. But for the next book, interestingly, there are contemporary painters whose work I am very interested in. So in a way, that's a sort of prescient question because it refers more to the next book than it is to the last one.
Which painters?
I'm not going to tell you.
Hand up over there. Yes.
Was it easy, ventriloquizing?
The question is, was it difficult writing male characters? Was it difficult ventriloquizing men? I've never really thought of writing as an act of ventriloquism. No, it's all right.
No, it's good. It's
a really interesting point of view.
What is weird about this is that it isn't difficult. I don't know why. Maybe it's just because one reads so much fiction that's written in a male voice. It seems to come quite easily. It's got something to do with the fact that fiction is, to a certain extent, a trick. It's not that you know exactly how men feel, but you can kind of fake it. And also you know how annoying they can be, so you put all that in. And so I remember years ago when I was beginning to write Strange and Norrell, the teacher, Tinch Minter, had given us an exercise to do, and everybody did it, and I immediately put it into the Regency period, and she said something about, you don't find it difficult to sort of go into another period of time, and I said no, but I do find it quite difficult to write summer during winter and winter during summer. So I can do men and I can do historical periods, or at least I feel I can. But I don't really like to do a different season than it is now.
That's just weird.
I know. Yep.
Yes. Question is, how do you splice together fantasy with documented history, I suppose? And make them work.
Yeah. The best way I can explain this was that I almost did it the other way around. Very often when people ask you questions about how you create, you know, how you decide what magic your magicians are going to do, there's a sort of assumption that you sit down and think about the most amazing things that you can possibly think of and do it that way. Whereas for a lot of the time with Strange and Norrell, it was almost the other way around. I would read the history. The Battle of Waterloo is a very clear example of this. When I set out to write that, I knew Strange was going to do some magic at the Battle of Waterloo, but I didn't really know what. The easiest way to work out the Duke of Wellington have wanted him to do, what would it actually have been useful, was to read what actually happened at Waterloo. And then it was simply a matter of changing a few of the strokes of luck that Wellington had, of which he had quite a lot at Waterloo, into things that Strange actually manufactured. So it was almost like, and that made the magic kind of more characterful and also more appropriate to the period, rather than thinking what could he do that would be spectacular, what would actually have been useful. The same in the peninsula, what would actually have been useful for them would have had some decent roads. Portugal was quite a difficult country to keep trekking across, so there was something very plain and practical and down to earth that he could actually achieve. So I think it was sort of that way round, really. Before I'd kind of decided what the fantasy aspect was, I read a lot of history and then the fantasy grew out of it.
So we're on the last couple of questions. Yes?
Both of your opinions. In a fist fight between Neil Gaiman and William Gibson,
Wasn't Bill Gibson asked this?
Sorry.
I got a message from people saying Bill Gibson was asked who would win in a... The question is, who would win in a fist fight between me and Bill Gibson? The idea...
I think it depends how tired Neil was at the time. That would have a lot. How many tours and how many countries you'd visited in the last, you know, week might have a bearing on it.
Nah, I could... I could take him. The idea that Bill and I would ever actually manage to argue about anything to the point where we'd fight. And he's so laid back anyway. Last time I saw Bill, I think it was actually to chat to, was years ago, and he just read Good Omens. And he said, "Hey, Neil, that Agnes Nutter book you wrote, I laughed some." Which actually I think is as good a review as you will ever get. It means he thought it was funny. He said that he thought I would win because I've got a leather jacket. I could intimidate him. Anybody who thinks I could do it because I wear a leather jacket.
But I think you might be worried about your leather jacket and therefore not as fight as fiercely.
There are more where this came from. I get Roz to beat him up. Right, last question then. Oh, there are so many of you. There. Yes, you. Yep.
Because of the fantastic nature of your story, do you think it would translate well to graphic novel format?
Because of the fantastical nature of your stories, would any of them translate into graphic novel format? Or even comics?
I don't see why not, really. I'm just trying to think about that. Yeah, I can't see any problem with it. I think as long as they didn't ask me to do it, really, because it's a different skill, and I am definitely untried in this area. There was, I did do a Sandman story. It's the one story which isn't in the collection. I did it for...
And a lovely story it is, too.
The Book of Dreams. I think... Yeah. The problem was you had to know a bit too much about the Sandemanian universe to kind of make sense of it, and outside of that universe, it didn't quite. There was a bit too much information missing, but I think one of the things was that I think DC still sort of hold the rights to make that into a comic at any point that they feel like. I think
if you simply told them that you'd like to see it as a comic, they would do it tomorrow. I think they're going to do it without your consent or blessing. I'd love to see that turn into a comic. Or even just with lots and lots of paintings, because I'm easily satisfied.
No, it would be a fun thing. I should like to see it, I think.
So I think that's a yes.
Yeah.
So a couple of thanks and a couple of apologies, first of all. Sorry about the fire thing. Sorry about stranding you out there on the pavement and freezing you all to death. And thank you all for coming back again, those of you
yes.
who did. And thank you all for not minding that Susanna is not signing tonight.
And yes, thank you.
Because she's if not actually
not
physically
mind.
Up to it and... We're very grateful that nobody is going to stand there going, but I've got all of her books and copies from Jonathan
Strange.
No,
that's all of your books. All of my books is like that.
they could have lots and lots of foreign editions, though. It could be those people with the suitcases filled with the interesting editions. All right, three things. They could have all the short stories in their original publication.
They could actually, yes.
But yes, sometimes they do.
That. I have seen that.
Anyway, so thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
And
thank
do you want to say your little bit? Go for it. Go on,
thank
say
you.
It. We'll stay here.
Thanks, Neil. I'd just like to say a huge thank you on behalf of the Observer and Blackwell to Susanna Clark and Neil Gaiman. A huge round of applause for them, please. Although Susanna will not be signing this evening due to health reasons, signed copies of the Ladies of Grace Adieu are available on sale this evening in the foyer at the special price of $5.99. But if you would like to get a book signed by Neil, he will be appearing at the Criterion on Tuesday the 2nd of October. So for more details and to get your tickets now, please go to the website hayfestival.co.uk. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much and enjoy the rest of your evening. Thank you.
Guardian Unlimited.